Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a 90-year-old veteran of the Tin Can Navy remembers fighting U-boats in the Atlantic and then brutal battles with the Japanese in the Pacific. His ship was shelling Iwo Jima's Mount Suribachi when one of the war's legendary moments unfolded.
We looked up and saw that flag going up, and it was the proudest moment of my life.
You'll be amazed by the close calls and inspired by his love for our country. That's today at 1, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our Hometown Heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service, for the sacrifices they made on our behalf, to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten. And along the way, learn a thing or two and also be inspired by how much these brave men and women love our country. And we're going to get a great story today from a 90-year-old Navy veteran of World War II. He was in before the war started and after the war ended. But let's go back before that. Growing up in Columbus, Kansas, Neil Green, what was life like as Neil Green in Columbus, Kansas during the Depression years?
Well, it was pretty rough. There weren't any jobs to have, and I had no future. There is one of the reasons I joined the Navy. Many of us did, because it was a way out of the poverty, and it was a tough situation. Much like they are today, their economic circumstances were such that we had little choice to do with our lives except that kind of thing. It opened us up, and I had no idea what it would open us up to, because the war hadn't started yet. But it started pretty soon after that. The fever was there. We knew about Hitler, and we knew about the war, and we knew that that was going to happen sooner or later. And when the war started, I had joined the Navy, and I was stationed in Panama aboard a World War I, called it four-pipe destroyer. It had four stacks, and they weren't much. In modern warfare, they weren't much. They were fast, but they didn't have any armament. They're tin cans, and that's called the Tin Can Navy.
And you would serve on a couple tin cans before you're done. I want to get one more thing on Kansas before we move on. You know, folks obviously think of Kansas in the 1930s, I guess, and they think of maybe the Wizard of Oz, and you're not in Kansas anymore. And you saw some storms. And in fact, people have heard of the Dust Bowl. And I don't know if people today really understand what that was like, but it was so bad you even had school canceled?
In a town that's quite away from the biggest part of the sandstorm, which was western Kansas, and we were in eastern Kansas, but it came over to there. It's just like a fog bank coming in. The street lights were turned on, but they were ineffective. It was almost total darkness in the middle of the day from the sandstorms. But our farms were wrecked like they were in there, where, you know, sand would take over the whole farm and the town. So it was an economic hardship for everybody, and everything seemed to be happening to those poor people in that time.
And you joined the Navy at just 17 years old. Had you graduated from high school yet?
No, I didn't graduate from high school. Then I joined before I graduated, and I've since got my college degree, and I have a high school diploma, but it was done in night school.
What was it about the Navy? Was it just a chance to get out there and see the world, an adventure? What was it that the Navy in particular did to draw you?
Well, I blame Frank Sinatra and Gene for Here Comes the Navy. You know, it was for a boy in landlocked Kansas, it was the dream, but there were propaganda films, and Gene Kelly and Frank Sinatra and all of those people made films like that. And so I just seemed like the thing to do, and I could go, so I did.
And your years in the Navy were exactly like the movies, right?
I saw the world all right, but I saw it from a very little of the land part. I was at sea almost all the time I was in. I was never stationed on a land-based station. And we went from the North Atlantic. We went, as a matter of fact, we sunk 14 submarines. The ship I was on, the little fleet I was on, sunk 14 submarines in the Atlantic, and that four-piper.
This is early on in the war, and not a part of the war that we hear about too often, because we hear about Europe and we hear about the Pacific. and people don't realize how much was going on a little closer to home. And as we get into that, one question I ask every veteran that I interview, because everyone seems to have a memory about December 7th, 1941. Not so many of them were already in like you were. Were you already down in the Caribbean when Pearl Harbor happened?
I was in Panama, and I remember walking. We were at the service dock fixing the ship up to get underway. I walked out on the forecastle where the officer of the deck was standing, and I said, "What's happening?" And because they were recalling, they had recall signals up on all the ships there. It was Sunday morning, and the people were ashore. And they were recalling them to their battle stations on the ships. And I said, "What?" He said, "Well, one of our naval bases is called Pearl Harbor." Well, I had no idea where Pearl Harbor didn't. Actually, he didn't either. It was a big thing if you were there, but the rest of the Navy didn't know that much about it unless you were in the Pacific. And we were in the Atlantic Fleet then, so I can remember it vividly. I can still see him standing on the deck and me questioning him about Pearl Harbor. We got underway. Late that night, but we didn't have any ammunition aboard, so we began to take ammunition, and people were falling over the side and falling down hatches. They weren't used to the blackout conditions. We thought that Panama would get it next. And we had old ships there. There wasn't any good ships, modern ships there, much as we were, old full-proper cruisers. And we all got underway. That was the days before radar, and we stood our watches. I remember standing and watching the crow's nest and spotting a ship through the mist, and we followed around till daylight broke, and we were ready to launch a torpedo attack, and we found out it was our own ship. But we did things like going into all of these little harbors all up and down the Central America and South America and getting the Japanese fishing ships out and taking them into Panama and making mine detection ships out of them, and that was an adventure. That was nice. At Galapagos Islands or Galapagos Islands, out we used to have boat races in the bay around there. So there was some pleasure in that. And then we'd go through the locks and go over to the Atlantic, which was much rougher seas. We spent a lot of time between Brazil and Africa, and moved up to the North Atlantic and anti-submarine things. And in those big convoys that coming out of Cuba, we in Guantanamo Bay, we'd pick up maybe 150 ships, and they would have a field day. The subs would infiltrate the thing, and you'd have three or four ships. It was a given that was going to happen. Was a sad thing, but it was.
This is in, I guess, probably 1942, that you're dealing with these German U-boats everywhere. And so you guys, as a destroyer, you're one of the outer rings of defense for these convoys. What could you do to take care of these U-boats? What were you prepared for as a destroyer crew?
We had the depth charge racks, and then they kind of invented the K-gun, which shot the canisters out and they would drop some and drop the pattern out, and we could drop depth charges. We dropped depth charges, and you don't always know if you're successful or not. You can see oil come to the surface, but they had the trick of putting things through the torpedo tubes and making you think they'd sunk them, life jackets and things. So you never knew.
And you especially were in situations where you didn't know, because you had a very unique spot on that ship that you were during some of these encounters with the German U-boats. Below deck, doing what?
I was in the steering engine room, and that's in a destroyer of that class, when they make a violent turn, that part of the deck would be almost completely underwater as they maneuvered, and the engine for the steering would be going off. And it was dark down there. There was no lights, and I was down there to pump water to the surface machine guns, which we couldn't use, but that's where I was stationed. And I'm a kid from Kansas, and I was locked in. I couldn't get out until somebody let me out. And you might say I was a little bit scared.
I'd be scared. I'd be a lot scared. When you say pump the water, so these machine guns on top of the deck,
the barrels were water-cooled. They're just 50 caliber machine guns with bicycle-type mounts, and they were ineffective. They couldn't do much with them.
Well, and they couldn't do anything if you weren't pumping the water. And when you say pumping the water, you're not flipping a switch. You mean manually
back and forth up, pumping water up to cool them. And we had they were all water cooled. We had about four or five of those there, and I happened to be probably the youngest guy aboard, and I looked like I was 14, and it was 17. I was 31 before they stopped asking me for identification when I bought a pack of cigarettes, you know.
Well, and you're looking good for 90 now. I'm trying to imagine what that felt like. And you just said you were a little scared. It had to be a pretty helpless feeling, and it's probably exhausting, too, doing all that pumping nonstop.
Well, that ship didn't have a lot of things like a modern ship does, like laundries and galleries, and everybody had their turn at peeling potatoes in the galleries on the top side on the deck, and they didn't have bakeries. And it was pretty almost like a sailing ship. It was a pretty old ship. It was fast, and it could drop lots of depth charges, and that's what we were designed to do, is protect against anti-submarines. And it was scary, and the tin can thing was, you know, we'd sleep on the decks because we thought that we might get blown up. I mean, that was it was the fear we had. The German U-boat fleets were very, very clever, and we lost the ship almost every night out of a convoy. We'd lose the ship. Fleets were very, very clever, and we lost the ship almost every night out of a convoy. We'd lose the ship.
So you slept on the decks because if you slept below deck and you got hit, you'd have no chance to survive.
Exactly, and we, at that time, everybody was issued hammocks. When we went through boot camp, we slept in hammocks. They since then eliminated canvas, but we had our own hammocks that we could string between the stanchions on the ship, and we'd go up there to sleep because you'd be trapped in it. It had no armament at all down below. It was literally a tin can.
And I guess with the tropical weather, it was warm enough that you could sleep in the outdoors like that.
It was very hot. Inside, they had wind sails hoisted, and most sailors today wouldn't even know what a wind sail is, but it scooped up the air in a funnel and put it down. But we didn't, and we came from the tropics to the North Atlantic, and we still didn't have anything. We didn't have heaters or coolers or anything. It was just, we went where they told us to go, and it was the basic getting ready for the war. The ship that I was on later was a modern seafaring warrior ship. On the first ship I was on, the first guys aboard had duty of feeding the crew. You'd have to go up on the deck and get the food and bring it down to the living quarters and then feed the crew. You were a mess cook, and everybody had to have their turn at mess cooking, and all the seamen.
How'd you do on yours?
It was kind of rough. I mean, when the ship goes up like this and you're going down a ladder with food, racks of food in your hand, they give away twice as much as they did when they came up, or vice versa. Yeah. So it was a basic ship, and we were all pretty hardy guys. I thought I was a real tough sailor, and I'd go around with, sitting dancing with my, thinking I was a salty, and then I'd go into a store down in Panama or something, and I'd hear a lady say, "Oh, look at that young boy in his sailor suit, doesn't he?" You know, and I think, I thought I was pretty tough. But
well, and along those lines, you mentioned you joined the Navy at 17, and you only looked 14. What about the rest of the guys on your ship? Did you have some of those older, saltier Navy sailors who had been in a while, and how did they treat this young boy from Kansas?
Well, a lot of the guys aboard ship were from the old Asiatic fleets, and to me they were ancient, but I don't suppose the captain was probably 28 or 29 or 30, you know, there were, but everybody was old when you're 17. Everybody's old, but we had gunner's mates and bosun mates that were in the old Asiatic Navy. Some of them had their teeth and some of them didn't. I mean, it's tattoos, and it was the old sailor type of thing. And then they began to get in the groups of reserves from New Jersey and places like that. So the younger people took over the ship, but there's still salty old sea dogs there. I don't know. They tolerated us. That's about the size of it. They tolerated us.
And you mentioned the U-boat threat and how ever present that was, and how much fear that incited in you guys. To put that in perspective, you said there were situations where you guys as a destroyer would actually be rescuing the sailors from a ship that a U-boat had sunk when you saw another ship sunk right next to it.
That's true. As a matter of fact, when we were in the North Atlantic, which was a typical convoy type thing, we were with a group. We had one Jeep aircraft carrier, that's a converted carrier that would carry maybe six or eight planes, and we were looking for submarines. But at that time we had a good idea where they would be, and one of our sister ship, there were two destroyers, our sister ship rammed one of the submarines, and they were locked together, and this was quite a newsworthy thing. They were knocked together, and we had to eventually we were to destroy our own ship when we tried to get the crew off the ship. And the Germans had picked up an Italian U-boat that we'd sunk. He'd picked up the crew from that, so we had Italians and prisoners and German prisoners. And the captain of our sister ship decided he wasn't going to abandon ship, he was going to save it. Well, they cut off the torpedo tubes and the guns, and they saw they weren't going to save it. So late in the day, they decided they'd abandon ship, and they put a line between the two ships. Of course, in the North Atlantic, the waves are tremendous, and you don't last more than 30 minutes in the water. But so the ships parted and snapped the line when there were a lot of life rafts in it, and it was beginning to get dark, and we'd leave the aircraft carrier, and the subs would go to the surface and chase the aircraft carrier, and we'd pick up some people and run over and drive the sub down and come back to pick up sailors. And some we didn't pick up. I remember the next morning we came across a life raft that had about 12 sailors in it. They were all dead. So I saw the captain of their ship, which we'd taken over, and he was really shaken by it. We all were. We couldn't stop the... To give them any service or anything. They just took a grappling hook and turned the life raft upside down and went away. That was war. That was the war. It was a sad thing.
That seems like an awful lot to digest as a teenager. Was there anything that helped you process that, deal with it? Did it just toughen you up? Did you become numb to it after a while? Or how did you endure those kind of moments?
We endured them because of our patriotism, which seems kind of corny today, but we thought that if I die, the people on my block back in Kansas will think what a hero I am, and he did something for his country, which was really important to us. So we're all driven by a patriotic thing, love of country. We see the flag in a strange country, a hair would stand up on the back of your head. I mean, it sounds corny now, but the love of country and Bing Crosby and all of the things that went with the love of country were prevalent then, and that's what we did it for. We were proud of what we were doing, and we knew it was essential, and fortunately, we're speaking English here now instead of German.
Amen. Or Japanese. And you had your encounters with both sides of that, and there aren't many people who experienced Navy battles against both the Germans and Japanese, and there certainly aren't a lot of them still alive today. So we're thankful for the perspective you can share with us here. But right now, we need to catch a break. We're going to find out how Neil Green ended up on a brand new destroyer and experienced most of the Pacific War aboard that ship when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there, free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, cvhonorflight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 90-year-old Neil Green of Oakland, California, originally from Columbus, Kansas. He served on Navy destroyers from before Pearl Harbor all the way through the end of the war. A little background on his two ships. We heard a bit about the first one. It was a World War I era destroyer called the USS Gough. It actually helped escort Charles Lindbergh back from his legendary transatlantic flight in 1927, long before Neil got aboard. You heard him describe the events of November 1943, when a sister ship, the USS Bory, rammed and sank a German U-boat in the Atlantic. But then the Bory had to be sunk herself, and Neil and his ship, the Gough, were a big part of that, as he told us. He didn't tell us that that action would earn the Goff the Presidential Unit Citation. The second destroyer he was on was called the USS Haywood L. Edwards, named for one of the first American casualties of World War II. Lieutenant Commander Haywood L. Edwards had been a heavyweight wrestler on the 1928 U.S. Olympic team, and he was in command of the destroyer USS Reuben James when it was sunk by a German U-boat in the North Atlantic on Halloween 1941, more than a month before Pearl Harbor. Out of a crew of 159, only 44 survived, and Lieutenant Commander Haywood L. Edwards was one of those who perished. Neal had participated in sinking many U-boats. Now he would serve on a ship named for one of the U-boat's victims. And all that duty on the Edwards would be in the Pacific. So how'd you come to serve on that brand new destroyer?
They wanted experienced seamen for the new ships. Our ship was turned into a minesweep, and that's the only shore duty I had, was putting that ship in commission. And that was the only fun part that I can think of in the Navy, putting a new ship in commission. We would go down to Bermuda, shake it down, and turn it, go fast as it'll go and slow as it'll go, and turn it and make sure it was ship shape. Then we formed out to go to the Pacific with some other ships, about 9 ships in a squadron. And we got some from Washington State, and we went through the Panama Canal and went to the Pacific, and I never came back. I never came back even as far as where there was any civilization. Guam was the most civilized place I'd been. I saw an American girl in Guam, and I hadn't seen an American girl in 2 years, you know. So, or any other kind of girl at sea, you don't see very many girls.
Yeah, you guys left Boston for good in April of 44, so the next year and a half or so, I guess, that ship was your only home.
Our first battle was Tinian and Saipan, and Guam, and then from then on, every invasion they had, I was involved in, because I was in that area of the fleet that supported landings, and we would go in the daytime before the troops got there, bomb the island, and retire at sea in the night, and come back in the daytime, and then when the troops came, we would be landing in support, and it would be like watching television. The landing boats would be coming by us, headed for shore, and all the drama and the gunfire aboard. As a matter of fact, Saipan and Tinian was the first really pissed battle we had. And I can remember a story in Saipan. The Japanese had a bonsai attack in the morning, and it drove the troops down on the beach. And we were sitting on, you know, not far from the beach with enough gunpowder to blow the island up. And yet there were so many Japanese soldiers and American soldiers, and the American soldiers were running down towards the water, the Japanese, we could see them. Get on their knees and shoot the American soldiers. We couldn't shoot back because, but they all swam to a little spit of land out off of the coast, and we sent our small boats over to pick them up. In the people we picked up was a Japanese soldier. They didn't know he was a Japanese soldier, but he had piled into the boat. I guess he'd seen enough of the war. And he was, as he came alongside, he had his arm over the side of the boat, and I can remember this, and the boat, the waves smashed the boat up against the side of the ship, and he broke his arm. But that was an interesting thing. Saipan was a shocker to us. They had so many suicide, people were committing suicide because they were afraid of the American troops, and they found that we treated them better than the Japanese occupiers did. But
there was so much propaganda from the Japanese. This is one of those famous spots on Saipan, a cliff where all these suicides took place. And these weren't men. These were women and children who'd been told by the Japanese that the Americans would rape and torture them. And you actually witnessed some of that?
I witnessed a lot of it, and I saw the results of it the next... When they jump, their husbands usually would throw the family over the side, or the women would do it, and the mothers and children would land on the beach, and it would kill them, and then the tide would come in that night and wash them all out to sea, and we'd wake up in the morning and see the sea full of bodies in grotesque formations with the children. It was an awesome sight. It was so unnecessary. And within 2 or 3 days, they found out that the Americans weren't the brutal people that they were led to believe they were. So it was a sad, sad place. It wasn't as fierce fighting as we later came into in some of the other islands like Iwo and all of those. The fighting was fierce. We lost more ships, But it was the beginning of what we were to experience later on in the war in the Pacific.
And I can't imagine, just as a human being, to see that kind of thing. And this was massive enough, the bodies in the surf, that you guys actually had to adjust the way you were running your ship so you wouldn't take in any of that water with all these bodies floating in it. As such a young man, I guess at that point you're about 21 maybe, but to see that, to see these children dying as casualties of this war because of what the enemy was telling them, did that anger you? Did it just shock you? Again, how do you look at something like that and figure out what in the world's going on?
There again, you have propaganda. To us at that time, they were just animals. We didn't have any compassion for them at all. We're there to eliminate them, and we did. I remember during the Battle of Surigao Straits when we had we'd sunk a battleship, and it was half blown up, and it was going backwards about 6 or 7 knots, and it was just full of wounded guys, and we had to sink the ship. We shelled it. There was a life vest full of one of their life boats were full of people, and the captain said, "Sink the lifeboat." What do? You sink the lifeboat. It's full of wounded Japanese soldiers, and the bodies flew every place right in front of us. And there were 300 or 400 guys swimming in the water. I saw a guy swimming towards our ship, and another Japanese guy came in, and the guy held his head back like this. And the guy cut his throat right below where I was looking. Apparently, it was an officer, and they thought he was going to defect or something, so he allowed himself to be killed. But they didn't even look at us. If they were turned in your direction, they might look up at the ship. If they weren't, they were so trained that they accepted death for the emperor, and really sad thing.
Yeah, they had been brainwashed, I guess you could say, to believe that dying for the emperor was the ultimate honor. But I guess that's one of those scenes that is why so many veterans have told me that war is hell. I mean, is that what it felt like to you at that point, that this is just an awful situation to be in?
It is, and this was all done through propaganda. You know, we're taught to hate them. They were taught to hate us. Can it happen again? Have we solved it? It seems to me that we really haven't. I don't know if it's a solvable thing. The hatred that can be generated by social means, I don't know how that we've escaped it yet. It bothers me that we might get into that same situation where life meant nothing to the Japanese army at that time. They would love to die. They'd bonsai attacks, and we shot down kamikaze planes, and we'd pick up the pilots that were killed, and they'd open up their wallets and find pictures of their family and their wife and their children, and realize then they weren't the animals we thought they were. They were somebody's father, and it takes you aback, takes you aback. And then you see one of our ships come in from picket station with bodies stacked up on the ship and the superstructure all blown up where the plane had hit it, then you felt different. I mean, you wanted revenge, and we got it.
Yeah, and let's talk about your specific duties on the ship, and I guess we can get into two other things that took you aback, like the moments where you realize, wow, that could have been it for me right there, and you and I wouldn't be sitting here talking. We wouldn't be talking about your daughter or your son or your long career and selling art materials, the great paintings that your wife did that you have on the walls around here. None of that would have happened. One of those situations, I guess, was you're manning a 5-inch gun or loading a 5-inch gun near Manila, and a bomber was heading straight for your ship.
Well, you could look around. There were probably 300 enemy planes in the air, and they were all diving on a ship, and it was just impossible. But we're in the long line, and the ships were in automatic, controlled by the device on top of the bridge, and the control officer said, shift to starboard. So we all 5 guns shifted to starboard, and I was looking through the scope. I'm looking right at a bomber right down on the water, coming right at us. Fire control officer squeezed the trigger, and all 5 guns went off at once and just blew him out of the water just because he ran into a hail of lead. It was that we were accurately shooting, but that was that was a long line of ships when we went in first to bomb and destroy Manila, actually, and that was we were the ships that did it then.
And just so everybody understands that, so you're saying those shells, those 5-inch shells, didn't explode. just the force of their impact knocked him out of the sky. And so that tells me if they had missed, if they hadn't been accurate, then he wouldn't have missed and you wouldn't be here. Am I exaggerating in that?
You're not. The California, we were there protecting the California in our line of ships, and it was hit three times right in front of us. I could throw a baseball and hit it. And right in front of us, it was hit by three kamikaze planes, which they had enough armor that it didn't do that much damage, but the explosion, the engine going through the armor, and the guys were falling over the side, and we couldn't even stop to pick them up. We threw our life rafts over as we went by, but we had minesweepers that came by and picked them up later. But there was just a ship being taken under fire anywhere you looked. They were just everywhere. And we just swung in and then swung out. And that was one of their last big, they had lost the fight for the Philippines right after that. I didn't land in Manila or stay there. We went in and bombed it and left. But they took it over so soon after that.
Well, and there really wasn't a significant battle in the Pacific that you missed out on. You saw all of it. And one of the things you saw, and maybe you foreshadowed this a little bit, because you talked about your patriotism and what it felt like to see the American flag flying in some strange spot. And the most famous image of an American flag from throughout World War II was the second flag, as the story goes, atop Mount Suribachi. There's a good story about the first flag and the second flag. The iconic Joe Rosenthal photo of the flag atop Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima, signifying Americans taking over that high ground. You saw that from aboard your ship, the Edwards?
I saw that, and I don't wonder how many guys that are still left would see that. I was on the bridge manning the voice radio when the officer of the deck said, "Look up there." We looked up and we saw the American flag. We're really close into the lobbing shells into the caves. We had Marine people aboard guiding our guns, and we were right up against it, and we were, it was looming right ahead of us. As a matter of fact, the USS Iowa, which was a major battleship, had come in. It was the only time I ever saw them do that. They were blasting the Suribachi with the rest of us, and we looked up and saw that flag going up, and it was the proudest moment of my life, I think. It was, but we hadn't taken it. I found out later that we hadn't completely avoided the enemy. Just a few days before, we were down the island away from the landing trip, and the ship, a sister ship and I, and the ship I was on, had anchored, and we're throwing star shells out every so often to keep the troops down from operating at night. And we started to get underway the next morning, and our sister ship was just here. It ran into a sandbank and grounded. So they were loading the ammunition from the front, taking it to the back of the ship to unload it, and we saw two water spouts come on each side of the ship, and that was when they zeroed in on it. Then the next battery hit right in the ammunition that they were loading, that hit right in the ammunition. And I'm sitting there watching it. I mean, this is, and suddenly the front of the ship just disappeared, and all the guys were on it. It just blew it right up.
And you mentioned seeing that flag, and we all see the photo in black and white, but you saw it in living color. What did that mean to you? What is that, one of those moments where you get goosebumps, where you feel that energy, and why?
Well, I don't think that it meant. We realized then that it would mean as much to the world and to the Americans as it did then. It was meant to us that we'd accomplished something on that island that was memorable, that we'd remember forever. But I don't think we had the scope of the thing that was to be of that particular act. But it was just one of the many things that we saw, acts of bravery committed by the people, and we were really proud. But it didn't have the same scope that it does now.
Yeah, I don't think anyone knew at the time how inescapable that image would be for the rest of history. And maybe if we can get you on an honor flight to Washington, D.C. to see the World War II Memorial, you can see the big bronze sculpture of those Marines hoisting the flag above Mount Suribachi at the Marine Corps Memorial. It is a larger-than-life depiction of a legendary moment that you yourself witnessed from aboard your destroyer. And that destroyer wasn't done. Iwo Jima, just the sixth of the seven battle stars it earned. You were on it from the very beginning. And we'll get the rest of Neil Green's World War II story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
They say a picture is worth 1,000 words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need 1,000 words, just 2 of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, 2 more. Ming's restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you 2 more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just gotta go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is 90-year-old Navy veteran Neil Green, a longtime Southern California resident. He now lives in the Bay Area. He grew up in eastern Kansas and joined the Navy before graduating high school. He was in before the war, served on 2 different destroyers, fighting first against the Germans and their infamous U-boats, and then in the Pacific against the Japanese. Neil was part of the original crew of the destroyer Haywood L. Edwards, involved in the battles of Saipan, Tinian, Peleliu, Surigao Strait, Luzon, and when we left off, he described seeing the stars and stripes rippling in the wind atop Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima. That wasn't the last battle you were at with the Edwards. Okinawa, of course, was after that, and it was at Okinawa that that kamikaze threat really intensified.
That was the worst part of the war for me. We lost a lot of our own ships, and there was an island called Karamareta where we sent these ships that were damaged, too damaged to fight. We'd send them back, and it was just full of bomb ships. As a matter of fact, when we run out of ammunition, we'd go and tie up to one of those ships and go down in its hold and take their ammunition out. We'd be working right next to a place where sailors were still entrapped, and you know, we're dead sailors in the compartments that in the watertight integrity of the ship, they were still there. I mean, that's how brutal it was, and the ships were just, we would have a ship completely covered with anti-aircraft fire, and it would still come down and hit the ship that was aiming at. I suppose if I threw a rock and you shot me, the rock would still go where I aimed it before I was killed. And the pilots must have been already dead, but it would have it from when we'd take it under fire all the way down, and it would come across our bow and go in. I remember the Lutz, I think it was, our sister ship, was blown up that way. We fired it all the way down across our bow, and it went right into that ship, just like a big hand pressing it. Just blew right up. That they could do a terrible damage with those things.
Did you ever think that your ship was going to get hit by one of those?
Let me tell you, I was on the front of the ship, the bow of the ship. I was on the second battery there, and I could see a plane coming right down at us. And I said, "Well, guys, those guys in the back, they're my shipmates, are going to get it because he's coming right at us." I thought of them. I didn't think somehow or other that I protected myself by not thinking they were coming after me. They were coming after my shipmates back behind the ship. That was just kind of I don't know if other people felt that way or not, but it was a matter of preservation. You had to believe that you were going to get out of it, but you knew in the end you might. And and there again, the motive of patriotism comes into effect. If I go now, my grandmother with whom I was raised would have a star in her window, and everybody'd be proud of her. And it was kind of silly now, but it wasn't silly to us at that time. It was the pride they don't see today.
Well, and you didn't know what else was in store for you in your life, and I'm sure, had you known all the things that you've experienced since, maybe your perspective would have been different too. When the war was over, and I don't want to skip over anything, feel free to inject any other close calls you had or moments that stick out in your memory, but when you heard that the Japanese had surrendered, what kind of day was that for you and all those guys on your ship?
Well, our ship was in Guam, and we were getting new guns. Our guns were worn out from all the shelling we had done. We're getting new main batteries, and we got underway shortly after that. It was a delightful day. I can remember, and I can't remember what island it was in. I think it was in the Philippines when Roosevelt died. All the ships that were all bombing the island. We were all firing at the island. And all the ships on command stopped firing. And then they all loaded and fired on a given radio signal. I couldn't tell you what it was because I could only, like everyone else, I could only hear our own batteries going off. But it must have been a great thing for the Japanese to hear that kind of a roar from all of those ships with the big 16-inch battleship guns going off. And at the same time, it was quite spectacular.
And symbolic, I guess, as well, huh?
Yes, it was. And there again, love for country and the president. And there was no political animosity that you heard about there. Everybody was an American. Everybody was proud of being what they were and doing what they had to do. But nevertheless, there were lots of bodies that didn't make it back, and I don't consider myself a hero. I offered myself. That's the way I figured. I offered myself, and nobody took me up on it. But the guys that were out there slogging around with a gun and standing tall while they were charging, you know, those are the guys that I consider heroes. I was a hero in that. Then I said, "Here I am. If you need me, take me." But I didn't want them to.
Well, I don't know if there's a more heroic choice. And every veteran I've ever had on this show, regardless of how many decorations he has, whatever citations he received, insists that he's not a hero, that the real heroes are the 400,000 Americans who didn't come home. But I contend that the rest of you were willing to be one of those, as you just stated, and that makes it a pretty heroic choice. And you said doing what you had to do, and you nearly had to invade Japan. That's what you guys were getting ready to do, to participate, at least shelling those shores as the troops landed. So it must have been a relief to you guys that this war was now over and you'd get to come home.
Well, I'm convinced if they hadn't stopped it, I wouldn't be here today, because we didn't have much of a chance of getting out of there. You know, that they were fanatical people and they were willing to die, everybody ashore, civilians and military, was willing to die to protect their land, and we would have had a lot of casualties. So I think probably I was saved, and as many others, but by the ending of the war.
So in other words, the use of the atomic bomb, all the lives it claimed, it saved exponentially more in American lives and Japanese lives, and you're one of those that it saved. Is that how you feel?
I feel that way. I feel that not only, like you said, not only the Americans, but Japanese, would have come out with the suicide runs, and the women and children would be pulling grenades out of their hair and blowing themselves up and blowing us up. It would have been a last desperate move, and I think it would have been too horrible to even contemplate. I think it was a necessary thing to do.
And to hear you say too horrible to contemplate after the things we've contemplated with you that you've shared that you did see, that adds some gravity to that. So when you get back home to the States, I mean, here you join the Navy at 17, and now you're coming out of the Navy, I guess in 1945, you would have been, what, 22 years old? That's a long 5 years, and you grew up quite a bit, I imagine. What was your perspective coming home?
At that time, they were letting you get your discharge wherever you were, and that you could, they would pay you for the train fare back to where you enjoyed. So I had a girlfriend a Kansas girlfriend in Los Angeles. So I came down to see her. The shipping over money and all of that, and I didn't. There weren't any jobs that we could would get right after the war. There wasn't anything to do. I just took it as it came. I entered business college and to start a career and just relished the life I was leading. It was good. And I finally married this girl that we were in high school together back in Kansas. She'd come back to visit every summer. So that's what got me to California. I got discharged out here. Instead of going home, I just stayed, and there wasn't much in Columbus to entice me back. So I've been here since 1945.
Yeah, and I know we don't have time to get into all of it, but a long, long career in the field of art. And your wife was an accomplished painter. You rubbed shoulders with many famous painters. Where did the art thing come from for you, the love of art? Was it something that you had doodled as a kid or got into in the Navy, or where did that come from?
I married the boss's daughter, actually, and she was the artist, and I was the merchant, and that's how it turned out. And we bought the business from him, and we were there for 40 years, I guess. She was the artist. She painted all the time. That was what she loved to do. It was a good career.
You've talked about your patriotism, the way you felt then, the way you feel now. You have grandchildren who weren't alive during World War II. You have children who weren't alive when all this was going on. What do you want people who didn't experience all of that to know about what you and those millions of Americans like you did, and why it needs to be remembered today?
Well, I think patriotism is what will lead us to a better life. If you've got to have pride in yourself and your neighbors, you got to take care of each other. The world can be a lot different than it is now through the belief in something. To me, they're just too materialistic now. They don't have faith in things. It scares me to think what the world can become if it goes the way it's going. And I think to have faith in things, and I get wound up.
What do you put your faith in?
I was raised a Christian, and I defend my... I can't say that I'm a great practicer of it, but I believe, and I believe in the hereafter, and I believe that I would like to see people be more in tune with the people they're living with here on this earth and enjoying it. There's a lot of joy to be had in that, but they're not they're too much at each other's throats today, too politicalized, and that disturbs me. I have no idea how to solve it, but I love America. I think it's the best place to live, and I think it's paradise on earth for other people. But people don't have faith in what I think they ought to have faith for. They have faith in, especially on the coast, on the two coasts. The Midwest is different. They're a little bit different back there.
My whole thing is, if you live something, then you're qualified to talk about it. And what you experienced, we've listened to today, and it's powerful. And so how you see it, I think, is important for us to understand, too. And you said that your faith was in God. You also said that you offered yourself up, willing to die for your country, and your country didn't take you up on it. When you think back on that now, and you think about your late wife and your children and grandchildren and all the fine folks that you've encountered over the years, do you feel that that God had a plan for you? That's why you didn't die? Do you feel like he was protecting you during the war, or is that too out there of an idea?
No, I believe it. I believe that I was protected. I ran across somebody the other day who commented that it was a couple of people that were asking me for directions, and my age came up, 90 years old, and I said, I guess I've been lucky. And she put her hand on my shoulder and said, you're not lucky, you're blessed. And I believed her. I have hopes for my grandchildren, and I dread that they might have to see the same thing I said that did, or something worse. I looked in their little angelic faces, and I think if I could protect you from what I have seen, though it hasn't been that horrible. The battle was a lot more immediate to the people who are standing with a gun in the hand, looking at a guy with a gun in the hand. The Navy was a little bit different, but you were still vulnerable to being killed. And I'd like to spare them, and I've told my children that I want you to be a part of America, a useful part of the society you're living in.
What's the biggest thing the Navy taught you?
I guess how to be a man. I didn't have a father. I was raised by a grandmother on the farm, and it was kind of a lonely life. I guess how to be a man. It took me a little while to learn that, how to be a sailor man. I mean, you know, it was brutal sometimes, but it was self-reliance. I had to look after myself, and I think that's helped for me. I've worked hard all my life, and I've accomplished more than I ever thought I would with God's help again. I'm fairly secure now and happy with what I've done. Things are looking up, and I can face whatever future I have, knowing that I've done what I could do for my children and my friends' children and my associates' children, and trying to make the world better. And I hope they continue that fight.
Well, I just want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for sharing some of your experiences and your perspectives with us. Is there anything that I didn't ask you about that you think it's important we know?
There isn't anything important except the survival of the country as I know it, as I knew it then. Probably wasn't perfect, but to me it was. It was worth fighting for, and I fought for it, and I'm proud that I did.
As well you should be. Neil Green has been our guest today. You'll find photos of him then and now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And I'll be back next week with another Navy veteran who survived 15 hours floating in the water when his ship was sunk. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you that freedom is not free.